It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Obama faces the thorny issue of what to do with thousands of children streaming across the borders of Central America. We'll look at how the issue is affecting politics, communities, and the children themselves.
First, we're taking a look at some news that broke earlier this week. The obesity epidemic has been well publicized in the United States, and a lot of experts blame all of the high sugar, high fat foods that fill our supermarkets.
But a new study from the Stanford University School of Medicine shows our daily caloric intake hasn't changed in the last 22 years. What has changed is the amount of exercise Americans get when they're not at work. This suggests that under-exercising, not overeating, is to blame for the obesity epidemic.
Lead author Dr. Yuri Lademan is with us. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Stanford School of Medicine. Yuri, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Well, what did your study find out about how much Americans today are exercising?
Let's start with those numbers, and then we can talk about how that relates to some of the other measures that you talked about. In summary, at the beginning of the time period of the study, which was late 80s, early 90s, approximately 10 to 20% of people said that they were getting no leisure time physical activity. And that increased in the latter period, which is around 2009, 2010, up to 45 or 50%. So a really significant increase in what people were reporting.
So that seems pretty remarkable as a drop. How would you put it into context?
I think there are a couple of caveats. A lot of people have been asking me how reliable these measures are. It's different to measure somebody's weight than to ask them how much they've exercised, and by the way, also how much they've eaten. And all that is true. So one of the first things that we have to point out is that this is based on self-report. So maybe people are reporting things inaccurately. But in general, when people misreport, they tend to underestimate how much they're eating and overestimate how much they're exercising.
Right.
So I don't think that is likely to explain the change that we see in physical activity report. However, the research methods that were used to ask people the question about physical activity did change over time, and it's possible that that could have affected things somewhat. So with those caveats, your question, how do we put this into context, I think it's quite dramatic, assuming that this does reflect a big shift in what we're doing with our leisure time. It's not good news that so many of us are moving so little when we're not at work.
Well, what would people do before when they got off work? They get off work and they hit the road and start jogging or biking, and now we're just filling our time with something else?
Good question. We didn't parse that out specifically in our study. The respondents were asked about specific activities and how much time they spent on those, and then there are certain energy expenditure values added to that. And yes, it's some of the things that you're talking about, walking, biking, some people would run, would bike, swim, and so on. And it just seems that the fraction of people doing that to a substantial degree was lower in the more recent survey cycles.
And as far as women go, the story is even more dire when you look at the amounts of exercise especially a certain age group of women seem to be getting now. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, all of these results varied somewhat by sex and by age. Overall, for women, we're closer to the higher levels of inactivity that I mentioned before, so closer to 50% now, men closer to 40%. But we saw some important changes in younger women that make us a little bit concerned, because that was also the group where there were some of the more important increases in obesity and also abdominal obesity.
Why did you look specifically at abdominal obesity?
That's a very important question. There is a lot of research that has looked at weight in general as a function of height, and this is what we use to calculate the body mass index. As people have a higher body mass index, they move from the normal weight to the overweight category and then to the obese category. Much work has shown that once somebody's categorized as obese, they have a higher risk of all kinds of adverse health outcomes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, mortality. But in addition to that, and independent of that, abdominal obesity or fat in the midriff, what people call belly fat, some people have called it beer gut, That condition, independent of people's body mass index, is associated as well with adverse health effects. So we were interested in both the trends in obesity as well as the trends in abdominal obesity. And there were some interesting things. For instance, the fraction of people categorized as overweight by body mass index. For those people in the population, there's a lot of debate as to what the health consequences are. But within that group, we saw that abdominal obesity was increasing. So that's almost a compounding of some of these trends within the usual categories that we tend to look at.
This seems pretty significant, and yet I know that sometimes people exercise and exercise and they still don't lose weight. That doesn't seem to be the magic key for them. We just had Gretchen Reynolds, the Well blog from the New York Times on, and we were talking a bit about that. So do you think we can really ascribe this more to exercise than to, you know, all the fatty, sugary food on the market?
No, I don't. And I actually welcome the opportunity to make this clarification because I think some of the coverage of our study may actually be presenting things in a way that is a little bit unbalanced. It's tempting to have catchy phrases such as it's exercise, not calories, or another study may come out, you know, a month from now that says it's calories, not exercise. I think if we just lean back, think about this sensibly, just as common sense, even as non-researchers. But then also, if you take a look at the totality of the research out there, we have to conclude that it's both. It may or may not be a productive argument to ask how much is attributable to one versus the other. I think that's going to be very hard to tease out. And there's no question that both are important. A simplistic way to think about this is that we need to achieve energy balance in order not to add weight as fat, so that you have to have a pretty close match between your energy intake and your energy expenditure in order to maintain weight. Is it useful to say how much of the overall population trend is used to one versus the other, is attributable to one versus the other? Maybe, but I think that's very hard to tease out. So that's the epidemiology. Now, what your question is getting at is what do you do about it if you're already overweight? And that's a totally different question. Absolutely, it is hard for people to lose weight. We all know that. Many times as people exercise, that also can change their caloric intake. For some people, it helps to modulate their appetite. Other people feel like eating more. So maybe a little bit of chasing your tail. The set points that people's bodies tend to defend are different. Some people just seem to settle out at one level versus another. So I recognize that in terms of the intervention for people who are already overweight, it's a big challenge. It is probably easier for us to think about maintenance of weight in people who are not already overweight. But both of these things require a lot of effort over a lifetime.
If you look at something like First Lady Michelle Obama's recent campaign, Let's Move, which is aimed at cracking down on childhood obesity, is that still the message here? Let's move. Let's get people moving. We don't know how all of these pieces of the puzzle fit together yet, but it's still going to be solid advice for people to exercise more.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important message. Exercise has a big role to play in weight maintenance. In some cases, it's successful at weight reduction, but it also has tremendous benefits beyond that. Even for people who are somewhat overweight, and even if they don't shed those extra pounds with the exercise, we know that being physically active and being physically fit improves the outlook in terms of health and also other things that are part of quality of life that may not necessarily be health related. So that is a very, very important message. You know, what strikes me is that we can view this as very complicated because the science is complex, the interactions are complicated, there are many layers to this discussion, and all of these things interact with one another. But on the flip side, we can also see it as relatively simple. It is, in the end, about a balance between caloric intake and exercise. So the message is simple. The implementation is really, really hard. But messages such as move, be active, I think should be put out there, should be heard, and I think that can really make a difference on a population basis.
We're talking right now with Dr. Yuri Lauterbaum from the Stanford University School of Medicine about his new study showing that under-exercising is part of the problem when it comes to the obesity epidemic in the United States.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Dr. Yuri Lauterbaum from the Stanford University School of Medicine. His new study looks at under-exercising and shows that that may be a big part of the obesity epidemic, but at least part of the puzzle here in the United States.
And we're taking your calls, too. What do you think? What do you do to incorporate exercise into your daily life? Or what do you think should or could be done to encourage Americans to exercise more? You can call in and let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go now to our callers. John is with us in Madison. Hi, John.
Hello. I had a point that perhaps people don't have a lot of leisure time to begin with due to a low pay rate in this country and having to work a lot to make ends meet. I mean, I don't have much leisure time to begin with. I try and get exercise in the morning, but it's not always easy. The days that I have to go in early, I have to mess around my schedule a little bit.
Right. That's a great point, John. I'm glad you brought that up. A lot of people working a lot of hours, people are under financial stress, and they may not feel that they have leisure time or any time where they can fit in anything extra besides just sort of the things you need to do to live. What do you think, Dr. Lauterbaum?
Yes, that is a very, very good point. And I think one of the key things here is to remove any adverse judgments. Let's say, oh, you know, why aren't you exercising? Because for many people, the intent is there, but the time or the facilities or other factors may not be there to allow people to do the physical activity that they'd like to do. So I absolutely sympathize with that. I understand it completely. You know, one way in which our modern lifestyle may be hurting us is that not only we may be working long hours, but in the past, many more of us used to exert more energy in work. There were different types of jobs. Much of what we do now is much more sedentary. And people also may have expended more energy getting to work. Now, many of us are driving everywhere and sitting around at work all day. And if you work long hours or if you have other responsibilities, there is little of this leisure time to then devote to physical activity. So all of this gets compounded. So I totally understand what the caller is saying, and that is part of the problem.
And we keep hearing news that grows more and more dire about how bad sitting is for us and the host of health problems that can come along when we sit for hours and hours at a day. Do you think that's, you know, part of this picture here?
It may well be. Here I'm speculating. It's certainly nothing that we measure directly, and it's not something that I have a lot of expertise on. So whether it's the sitting alone or whether it's the absence of getting up and doing other things, I don't know. But it's true that sitting around may have its own problems, whether they're just mechanical in our body or otherwise. But I think part of it is also the trade-off. If we're sitting around a lot, we're not doing other things.
Well, thank you to John for the call. And next we go to Rachel in Milwaukee. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually have a question. How much do you know about genetics and how they play a specific role in, you know, how much exercise one person needs versus another? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Rachel. And Dr. Lauterbaum?
That's a very, very interesting point. I would say that until now, we have a very limited genetic understanding of how this works at various levels. There are definitely differences among individuals with respect to what seems to be the weight level that their body defends and how much exercise they or energy expenditure they need to maintain that. And in addition, what effect the exercise may have on their cardiovascular or other fitness. We are far, very far from being able to understand this at a discrete genetic level. I will say one thing, though, and that is that there are some relatively extreme syndromes where people are quite obese, but those are few and far between. So the trends that we are seeing in the population at large, I don't think can be explained by genetics alone, because the genetics in the population haven't really changed that much. However, there are some subgroups that are much more susceptible to weight gain under certain conditions, and that's where the confluence of our modern lifestyle may be creating problems, because populations that may have been traditionally doing very well with certain types of diets, certain types of daily activity, all of a sudden things start to change, unfortunately, more towards what we call the Western lifestyle, and all of a sudden you see these increases in obesity, type 2 diabetes. That's been part of the problem in Western and more industrialized countries, but this is being seen more and more in developing countries, so it's becoming a worldwide issue. So the short answer is we are far from being able to tease out the genetics. Yes, there are some groups that are more susceptible than others, but I don't think it explains all of the trends, so we have to look at the environmental factors.
Okay, thank you, Rachel, and we'll go next to Dan joining us in Green Bay. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, hey. I've noticed a big change in the last 20 years, and I just Googled that the average American watches 34 hours a week of TV, and then you throw the video games and the computer on top of that, and I just don't think people are, I think they have the time. I just think they're prioritizing other priorities.
It's an interesting case there. And also, it occurs to me to ask whether when we're talking about screen time, or we're just talking about screen time in our leisure time, because certainly a lot of us spend a lot of time looking at screens at work, but certainly people are watching screens. They're playing on their devices. What do you think about that and how that might factor in, Doctor?
I think that could certainly be an issue. Again, I'm talking more out of my general knowledge of this area than anything that I've researched, but certainly people have asked me about this and people bring it up. They say our life is much more electronic. We're doing all these things on screens. We're sitting around instead of being outside and doing things. My observation is that has definitely increased, and I think that probably does account for it. So if we put together some of the things that the callers are raising, one, some subgroups in the population may not have that leisure time. Two, the ones who have leisure time are using to spend it in ways other than moving around. All of these things, I think, are adding up to the big picture.
So we've got a piece of this puzzle here. You found out that Americans are exercising far less. It seems that they're eating the same caloric intake. At least that's what they're reporting. So what is the next step to teasing this out?
Well, that is a challenging question. And I think what we have to ask ourselves is, where will our energies be best used? What should we be doing next? And there are various research approaches that people could try to take to try to figure out, is it more the intake problem? Is it more the expenditure problem? But I really think that in terms of the societal priorities, we should try to look at interventional research. What is it really that can make a difference at the individual level and even at the population level? So that's not the type of work that I personally am engaged with, but if I were to set priorities for the field and for the society in general, it's really now at the point where we need to say, we may not have all the answers. We don't know exactly how much is due to one thing or the other. You can argue about some of the magnitudes of the effects, but we have a pretty good idea that intake matters, energy expenditure matters, and we have problems on both ends. So what do we do about it? What do we actually get our kids to be doing? People who are already overweight, what's the best way to treat them? So that's what I would prioritize.
I notice you don't sound like you're scolding people about this. This could be the kind of thing where there was a lot of finger wagging going on, saying, shame on you lazy Americans, get off the couch and start exercising. It seems as though you think that maybe there are some good reasons that we're not exercising, and maybe it's not our fault totally.
Right. So I definitely think that scolding doesn't help. This has to be all taken as a constructive conversation of what we can do. But I do have to say that there are some trends out there that try to take away any personal responsibility, and I don't think that's right either. As with most things, the interactions here are complicated, and it's not all black or white. Is it all the environment? Is it all society? Is none of it under our control? No. On the other hand, is it just that we are fat and lazy and we are gorging? No. It's a combination of things. What can what ultimately we can control as individuals may be limited, but that's where our personal responsibility comes in. And for some people, it's not that limited. Many people do have a lot of time and they have a lot of choice over their foods. The most vulnerable populations tend to be those for whom the food choices are bad and their environments are bad. It may not even be safe to be out and walking around. And in those settings, I think they're really much more victims of the environment than they are essentially able to affect things out of free will.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Yuri Lauterbaum, professor of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get inspiration for garden fresh, savory summer pies.
But first, immigration has been pushed to the forefront in recent weeks as President Obama grapples with what to do with the more than 52,000 unaccompanied children that have streamed across the U.S. border from Central American countries since last October.
The president asked Congress for $3.7 billion in emergency funding. He's been under fire from both Republicans and immigration advocates who oppose the president's move to try and offer voluntary removal as an option to the undocumented children.
Fawn Johnson joins us now. She is a National Journal correspondent covering domestic policy issues. She's been covering immigration since the Clinton administration. And Fawn, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, first, the question that we should ask first is, why is this happening now? Why are we seeing this surge of migrant children coming across into U.S. borders?
There's no real good answer to that question, but the best explanation that we have is that there has been a surge in violence in those three countries. This is primarily Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And for whatever reason, there has been this thought from parents that if they bring or send their children up to the United States, that they will be taken care of here. And to a certain extent, that view is correct. The 52,000 or so children that have come across since October have to go through some extensive screening before they can be formally deported back to their own countries if they don't have a reason to stay here. And the immigration services are massively backlogged. So a lot of the kids who have come since October are still here.
I've seen reports that there are even toddlers who have made this journey. What is it like?
Well, there are a couple different ways to come up through Mexico. They're mainly coming up through Mexico and arriving in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. They can be coming on roads generally through some sort of coyote that they will pay, or their parents will pay to take them with them. That's a dangerous route to take, and those particular people who would be ferrying these kids need to pay off border police and whatnot in Mexico. Another way that they can come, and this is even more dangerous and difficult to imagine, is there is a railroad that goes from some of the southern parts of the Mexican border all the way up through to the Rio Grande area. And kids who don't have the money, which can cost $3,000 to $7,000 to pay someone, can jump onto that train and ride alongside it or on top of it to come towards the part of the northern border between Mexico and the United States, and then they can sit and camp out there for a little while and have some help coming across the border.
Are there parents coming with them, or is it just primarily children?
There are some people who are coming with families. That's one of the things that I think people don't realize, is that while the numbers of unaccompanied minors that we've seen have surged, there's also a surge of people coming across with their children. Now, if they are apprehended, so you have an entire family unit or, say, a mother and a couple of children that are apprehended, then the way they are treated is somewhat different. And the Border Patrol officials can repatriate those people back to their home countries relatively quickly because they have an adult present. The difficulty comes when you have someone who is determined to be a minor that doesn't have a guardian. At that point, then the Border Patrol needs to turn those children over to the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Department of Health and Human Services needs to find someone to act on their behalf.
So currently, what happens to these kids and sometimes their parents once they get here?
Well, if they come without their parents or without a guardian, they wind up in the auspices of the Health and Human Services Department. And part of the problem is that this was an unexpected surge. They do have procedures for dealing with unaccompanied minors generally, but it's about a third bigger than they expected it to be, and it all started happening over the last 6 months or so. But anyway, those kids show up and they are put into the custody of Health and Human Services. They are in shelters essentially. And right now, the Health and Human Services Department is setting up emergency shelters on military bases all around. They just don't have enough room for these kids. So they're given medical treatment. They're given education. They're given some, depending on their age, legal, I wouldn't call it representation, but some legal instruction about what their options are. And then HHS looks for someone inside the country to take care of them. It's important to note that of the kids who have come over, almost half of them have been reunited with a parent here in the country through HHS. So some of those kids are here with their parents. It's not clear if those parents are documented, but they are with their families, which I suppose we can be glad about.
I've seen some pictures out there of these kids almost being warehoused in what look to be pretty bleak conditions.
Yeah.
Is there evidence that their basic needs are being met while they're here?
Everything that I know, and keep in mind I haven't been there, would be that I think that their basic needs are being met. The problem is that they are taken into custody at the Border Patrol, and Border Patrol has never been in a position to house people long-term or to house massive amounts of them long-term. It's supposed to be a really quick turnover period where if it's an adult, they'll be turned over to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which will put them in some sort of detention facility or come up with another way to deal with them. So the pictures that we are seeing of kids in these detention centers at the border are kids who have just recently come across and are flooding the parts of the Border Patrol that were never intended for them. And the other issue, of course, is that the Border Patrol doesn't have a lot of facilities to care for children. And when you have more children than you expect, you wind up having to put them in one place. And they're doing everything they can to try and get them out and put them into a more appropriate shelter. But I think it's safe to say that some of those kids find themselves in some close quarters for at least a couple of days, maybe, while they're waiting to get to a better shelter.
And it's worth pointing out that Milwaukee is being eyeballed as a possible place to take in maybe 100, 200 of these kids, but the verdict is still out on that. And moving to the political side of this, on Tuesday, President Obama asked Congress for $3.7 billion in emergency funding to help deal with the situation. What kinds of things would that money be used for?
It's going to a number of different places. One of the areas that he is looking for is actually bolstering. There's more than $1 billion that would go to the Health and Human Services Department to provide permanent shelters for these children. The Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department said yesterday that when you have temporary shelters, that's actually more expensive than it is to just have permanent facilities for the kids. So that's one of the things that he is requesting. Another thing that he wants to do is pay for a big increase in the number of immigration judges that are available, because that's part of what's causing the delay for these kids, is that they can't get them in front of an immigration judge quickly enough, which is one of the procedures that has to happen. It would also go to bolster enforcement along the border. So this would be people who would be investigating whether or not these kids are coming across in a trafficking ring, and also trying to just generally police the border in a better fashion.
And getting this money doesn't seem like an easy green light from Congress at this point. What has to happen?
Well, the president needs to convince the members of Congress that the money will be going to places that they think is appropriate. The biggest complaint from Republicans in Congress is that the money right now looks like it's going to the border to help a bunch of kids who have crossed illegally to stay here. And it doesn't help that, of course, the law requires that's essentially what happens, that they come here and then we as a country take care of them. But they also want to make sure that there's a quicker way to process and get these kids back home. And they want to make sure that the president is sending a very clear message to the Central American countries that they should not be sending their children to this part of the country. It's getting mixed up in a lot of complaints that they have about how the president has handled immigration generally, and that doesn't help. There's a lot of distrust between the president and the Republicans in Congress anyway. So I think that what you're going to see is you're going to see a number of requests to either require the president to deport a certain number of people at a certain amount of time or to change the law to allow him to bypass some of the things that are currently required for these children. And there are some people who oppose that. So it's starting to get to be a political battle that could drag out until September, because we only have a couple of more weeks in Congress before all the lawmakers recess in August.
Do you see this lighting a fire under politicians for immigration reform?
That is always a possibility, but it's hard to know what will actually move them. The debate about immigration has gotten so twisted and so difficult over the last couple of years that it's difficult to find a way out of it. And there have been a lot of conversations among both Republicans and Democrats who are heavily involved in immigration to break it down and to try and make the individual parts of the issue become their own isolated pieces and move those separately. That has fallen by the wayside mainly because of distrust of the president on Republicans' part. So it's difficult to see how this particular situation can do anything but make it worse. The president is, I think it's incumbent upon him to just point out that this is an emergency situation and these kids need to be taken care of, which he is doing. But then in order to move the immigration debate forward, he's going to have to explain to the country and to the people in Congress how he's going to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And that's hard to do.
Fawn, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Fawn Johnson, National Journal correspondent covering domestic policy issues. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. It's Food Friday, and today we're talking about savory summer pies. Farmers markets are starting to fill up with fresh vegetables, and a summer pie is a great way to put them to good use.
Ian Knauer is back with us. He's the host of the PBS series called The Farm and the author of the cookbook by the same name. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, I am a huge fan of pie and all of its permutations. When I think of savory pie, though, right away my mind goes to a quiche. What kinds of alternatives are there out there for savory pies that aren't quiche?
Well, all sorts of alternatives. Although I have to say, I'm not one to kick a quiche out of bed either. So I love a quiche for breakfast or brunch. But this week, I've been making cherry tomato pie. Because my cherry tomatoes are ready in the garden, even though the rest of my tomatoes are maybe a week to come. So this is a really fun pie. I take about 2 pounds of cherry tomatoes, and I have them, and I toss them with a little bit of mayonnaise, believe it or not, and a whole bunch of herbs and a little bit of cornstarch. And then I put them in a pre-baked pie shell and put that in the oven for about 45 minutes. And those cherry tomatoes sort of burst, and all their juices are thickened with the cornstarch, and you end up with this really incredible savory cherry tomato pie.
Wow. We're at a point where these vegetables are going to start bursting right off the plants there. Why are pies the perfect solution to putting those vegetables to good use?
Well, it uses up a fair amount of vegetable, too, because like zucchini is a great example of one of those vegetables where, you know, once you get one out of your garden, all of a sudden you have a dozen, mm-hmm. and you don't know what to do with them. You're just making zucchini bread for the rest of the summer. So zucchini is another one of those vegetables where I really like to put it in pies. And it is also a vegetable that is quite watery, so the way to make sure that it doesn't sog out your pie crust is to slice it super thin. So if you have one of those adjustable blade slicers, like a mandolin, this is the time to use it. So I like to slice it sort of paper thin and then make a thin layer of zucchini. A great pie is a zucchini cheddar pie. So that's one that I actually made last night for dinner.
Oh, well, what's in that one besides the zucchini and the cheddar?
Well, not much, actually. It's zucchini, cheddar, a little bit of Parmesan cheese, and then I like to sprinkle some thinly sliced hot pepper over top, so some chili pepper over top, just for a little bit of heat.
That sounds good, too. Well, can we talk about the crust for a minute? Because summer, I feel like the cooking should be a little easier. I shouldn't have to feel bad about myself, for instance, because I can't make a perfect pie crust. Is there a solution to a no-hassle pie crust here?
I think maybe one of the easiest crusts to make is an oil crust. So these became sort of famous in the 1920s, and the Wesson Oil Company started putting an oil crust on their label so that people would know how to make an oil crust. I actually like to make an oil crust with olive oil just because the flavor of olive oil is so incredible. So the way to do this is to take your flour. You start out with about a cup of flour, and then you add about a third of a cup of olive oil. You kind of work that in, and what happens is it starts to look like a regular pie crust. It sort of beads up, and the oil becomes kind of lumpy. And so you have these little pea-shaped lumps, which is also what you're looking for when you make a butter crust. And then you want to add a little bit of water and salt. So you end up adding about 2 to 3 tablespoons of water and half a teaspoon of salt, and you end up with a dough that looks just like a regular butter crust. You don't have to let that rest. You don't have to worry about having hot hands because you're not going to melt the butter. The oil is already liquid. And then you just roll it out, or you can even press it into your pie crust or your pie tin and just bake that off. It's a really easy and also delicious crust.
Okay, well, that sounds convincing. And that recipe is up on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way, as is the recipe for that cherry tomato pie you mentioned.
And we, you had shared a couple of other recipes with us, one for rough puff pastry and one for biscuit dough. What do we want to consider when it comes to the taste of the crust as we think about the other ingredients that are going to go inside the pie?
Well, that's a really excellent point. So that olive oil crust is great for the cherry tomatoes because olive oil and cherry tomatoes are a classic combination. I really like that rough puff pastry with the zucchini pie that I mentioned earlier, the zucchini cheddar pie, because you get this super flaky crust and a very tender cooked zucchini filling. So you have some nice contrast there. And then the biscuit crust that you mentioned is also one of my favorite. It is almost cloud-like. You get this really fluffy, biscuity bottom and top crust, and that's good for like a tomato and corn pie, which is another one of my favorite summer savory pies.
So is it kind of like a savory cobbler?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I never thought of it that way, but that's the perfect way to describe it.
All right, well, walk us through that one. What's in it?
So the biscuit crust has butter in it, so you're going to cut the butter in with your pastry cutter, or with your fingers is fine. You can even pulse it in with a food processor. And again, you're looking for those pea-sized lumps of butter here. You want some chunks of butter because that's going to give you really nice flake to your crust. And then you're going to add some milk, and in with your flour, make sure you have some baking powder, which is what gives it some nice fluff there for your biscuit. This is kind of a wet dough, and it makes enough for a top and a bottom crust. And I like to roll it out between wax paper or plastic wrap so that you don't end up with it sticking to the counter, which, because it's a wet dough, tends to happen a little more easily. So to avoid that, just roll it out between some wax paper, transfer it to your pie tin, and then I like to fill it up with layers of sliced beefsteak tomatoes, some fresh corn kernels, and a whole bunch of herbs, and then top it off with even more cheddar cheese. I think you'll see a theme here. Cheddar cheese is something that I really like to bake into savory pies. And then that top crust, you roll it up in the same way between wax paper and put it right on top. Put some steam vents in there, and then throw that in the oven, about 400 degrees. And it doesn't take long, about 30 minutes. What happens is the biscuit dough sucks up all those tomato juices and gets nice and brown on top. And the tomatoes and corn, they're not super cooked. You just sort of cook the raw out of them. And they end up being this really refreshing treat. I love this pie when it's hot out of the oven, but I also love it cold, even for breakfast the next day.
Wow, that sounds fantastic to me. And I love the cheese in there. You know, it's Wisconsin. But Cynthia was wondering about the mayonnaise. Can you make the case for what the mayonnaise does in that pie?
Yeah, so this recipe is actually based on an old James Beard recipe and was updated by a food writer in the 70s called Lori Colwyn. She did some really awesome stuff. She was a contributing writer for Gourmet magazine. And she put the mayonnaise in there. And what happens with the mayonnaise is it sort of melts and becomes part of the sauce in there. It mixes with those tomato juices and the corn juices. You don't really notice it once it's cooked. But it sort of laces everything together. It does this magic trick inside the pie.
Are you convinced, Cynthia?
I'll give it a try. We'll see. You had also shared a recipe for eggplant lamb pie. Eggplant seems to be one of those vegetables that people either love or hate, but how do you use it here?
So the eggplant in this recipe is really an important ingredient. It cooks down and becomes the thickener in the pie. So this filling doesn't have any cornstarch or tapioca or flour in it. But the eggplant, of course, you know, eggplant gets so silky when it's cooked. And that's what happens here. So the eggplant breaks down and it sort of binds together the tomatoes and the ground lamb. And there's some really nice warm spices in there, too. You don't actually know, it doesn't taste like an eggplant pie, but the eggplant is what holds everything together in this pie.
Ian, this has got to be heading into the super busy time in your garden, and I know you do a lot of gardening on your family farm. Are you hitting that period where you're starting to get frantic and it's coming up fast and furious?
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned last week, I walked through the zucchini patch and I thought to myself, oh no, it's starting. So I'm already giving the stuff away.
Well, feel free to give some away here in Wisconsin. I'm sure it would make the travel just fine.
So, Ian, thank you so much for joining us today for Food Friday. It was great to talk with you.
Oh, so great to talk with you both.
Ian Knauer is the host of the PBS series called The Farm, and he's got a cookbook out by the same name.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.